In 2 Samuel 7, God makes a covenant with David. He binds his house to David's house forever, saying to David, I am your father, you will be my son. He binds his throne to David's throne, and the New Testament confirms this and indeed shows us how this promise of God to bind his throne to David's throne is fulfilled. In Acts chapter 2, when Peter is preaching the gospel after Christ's death, resurrection, and ascension, Peter makes reference to God's covenant with David, his oath to David. In his sermon in Acts 2, Peter says, David died and was buried, and his tomb is with us to this day, but being a prophet and knowing that God had sworn an oath to him, that oath is the Davidic covenant, that he would set one of his descendants on his throne, David foresaw and spoke about the resurrection of the Christ. Can you notice that in Peter's sermon? David said his descendant would be set on his throne. Jesus sits on the throne of David. The risen Christ sits on the throne of David right now and will for all eternity. But it's interesting because then Peter goes on in that sermon in Acts chapter 2, and he quotes from Psalm 110, a psalm of David that goes like this. The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. In Psalm 110, the Father invites the Son to sit at his right hand. Jesus is enthroned on David's throne, which is the same as being enthroned at the right hand of the Father on the throne of God. David's throne and God's throne are ultimately one and the same. They become one and the same in Jesus. David's throne is God's throne. Understanding that's really the key to understanding the Davidic covenant. David's throne is God's throne. And of course, that makes sense because the one who sits on that throne is both David's son and God's son. He is man and God, two natures in one person. In the covenant God makes with David in 2 Samuel 7, God promises an eternal king who will come from David's house. And of course, that king is Jesus. Jesus is great, David's greater son. David serves as a type of Jesus, a foreshadowing of Jesus. And this is really the main way to read the David story in the Old Testament. He is a type pointing ahead to Jesus. He's giving us a pattern that Jesus will fulfill. Now, like all types, he's imperfect, he's flawed, but he really does preview the coming Christ. And one of the ways he previews Christ is in the great victories he wins. And we see that here in 2 Samuel 8, our chapter this morning, the great victories he wins. Victories he wins to protect his people and to further establish and extend his kingdom. That's really what this chapter is about. When God made the covenant with David in 2 Samuel 7, David was in a period of peace and prosperity, but of course in a fallen world, peace rarely lasts long. And so here in 2 Samuel 8, we find the peace is broken and David is back at war. God had promised David victory over his enemies, and here David scores one victory after another. In this chapter, it is victory after victory after victory for David in fulfillment of that promise God made to him in 2 Samuel chapter 7. We see in all of this that not only is David a preview of Jesus, but David's kingdom and the growth of his kingdom and the victory of his kingdom, all of that points ahead to the growth and victory of Christ's kingdom in history. It's really what it's showing us. This whole passage is an image of Christ and his kingdom. It's pointing us ahead to Jesus and to his kingdom. Here, David goes forth conquering and to conquer. And of course, that is exactly how the book of Revelation describes Jesus. He is the conquering, victorious king, the one who goes forth conquering and to conquer. This chapter catalogs David's remarkable victories. And as we read this chapter, it should fill us with hope. As we read this chapter, we should be brimming with hope because this chapter shows us how history is going to unfold. As we read this chapter, it fills us with the expectation that Christ will vanquish his enemies over the course of history, even as David vanquished his enemies. If David defeated his enemies, how much more will the greater David defeat his enemies? Of course, even though God had promised David victory, these victories were not automatic. David still had to fight for them. He still had to go on the battlefield, and he had to trust God as he fought, and he had to fight bravely and skillfully. But he knew that God was with him, and he knew that God would give him the victory. In this chapter, David fights a variety of wars. Some of these are defensive wars because David is under attack. Some of them, you could say, are wars of recovery to take or take back land that God had promised to Abraham. So it was land that rightfully belonged to David and to his people. If you look at the geography of this chapter and where these different peoples that David fights against come from, what you will find is this. In this chapter, David fights in four directions, to the north, south, east, and west. It's as if David is extending his kingdom in all four directions. It's like his kingdom is extending out to the four corners of the earth that God has promised him. His kingdom is growing in all four directions. By the time the fighting in this chapter is done, Israel will have doubled its territory and will be receiving tribute from multiple nations. By the time the fighting in this chapter is finished, the borders of the nation of Israel will match the land borders God promised to Abraham back in Genesis 15. That is to say, the promise of a land to the people of Israel will be fulfilled. The promise of a place that God made to Abraham and again to David will be fulfilled because the promise of victory over enemies will be fulfilled. And here David does what even the great Joshua could not do. He conquers the entirety of the promised land. He claims every square inch that God promised to Abraham. David is the seed of Abraham who takes full possession of the land God promised to Abraham. We see that here. A little more context here before we get into this chapter, because we actually know more about these battles from 1 Chronicles, which gives us another account of David's life, and also from Psalms that go with them. And in particular here, it's Psalm 60 and Psalm 18. We didn't read them this morning, but I can tell you a little bit about them as we get into this. Those Psalms in particular, Psalm 60 and Psalm 108, give us more insight into these battles in 2 Samuel chapter 8. I have to preach on the Psalms that go with David's covenant in chapter 7 and also these battles here in chapter 8 at some point. But for now, let me just tell you a little bit about Psalm 60, because Psalm 60 is particularly helpful in shedding light on what's happening here. The title of Psalm 60 tells us when it was written. It was written when David was fighting against Syria of Zobah in the north. That is recorded in 2 Samuel 8:3. And the title of Psalm 60 tells us, while that battle was going on, Joab, one of David's high-ranking military officials, his secretary of war, Joab had to go fight the Edomites in the south. And that's recorded in this chapter in 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 13. Psalm 60 is covering the same ground as 2 Samuel 8. In fact, it's interesting, the content of Psalm 60 also mentions battles against Moab and Philistia, other enemies David faces in this chapter. So all four major enemies David fights here in 2 Samuel 8 are referenced in Psalm 60, and at least a couple of those battles are fought simultaneously, if not all of them. In fact, based on geography and some of the other details we can piece together, it seems that what happened is this. David was off fighting the Syrians in the north. The Edomites from the south and the Moabites from the east formed an alliance, so a Moab-Edomite alliance. They swept in engaged in a surprise attack against Israel from their direction. So think about this. David's up fighting in the north. There's a surprise attack launched from the south and from the east. Think about this. First application here. If you feel like the church is fighting battles on multiple fronts right now, with enemies coming at the church from several different directions all at once, you should be able to draw encouragement from this chapter because David faced exactly the same thing. Now, of course, in the new covenant, we fight differently. Our battles are primarily spiritual in nature, but there are analogies, and that's why we're given so many stories about warfare in the Old Testament. There are analogies between the kind of warfare David fights here and the kind of spiritual warfare the church is called to fight. David faced war on multiple fronts at once. He was waging war against multiple enemies in multiple directions at the same time. And today, the church often finds herself fighting wars on multiple fronts as well. Think about it. We fight against false religions and cults, like Islam and Judaism and Mormonism. We fight against secular ideologies like progressivism and feminism and LGBTQism. And of course, we have to fight against the temptations that are common to all of us, that Satan brings against all of us, temptations to lust and pride and gossip and so on. We are getting squeezed and attacked on multiple fronts. We are fighting enemies, as it were, to our north, south, east, and west right now. That's the situation the church is in, under attack from multiple directions, fighting battles on multiple fronts. But what 2 Samuel 8 shows us is do not fret in the midst of this. Do not worry or panic. David faced the same thing and came out victorious. The church, the army of the new David, can as well. Now, let's look at a few details here. As verse 1 tells us, David fought Philistines to his west. He attacked the Philistines and subdued them. He took Metheg-Amma. Metheg-Amma means mother city. It means David captured and conquered the capital of Philistia, which we know from 1 Chronicles 18 was Gath at this time. Gath was a city David was familiar with. He had visited it a couple times. It's actually Goliath's hometown. And of course, what's being indicated here is that by capturing the mother city, David has really conquered the nation. If you control the mother city, you really control the whole nation. And that's what David does here. He utterly defeats Philistia. He defeats their greatest city. In fact, the word here in my translation, it says attack in verse 1. Other translations may have to defeat or something like that. Maybe it's best translated as to smite the enemy. David smites them and subdues them. And even though it can get translated differently throughout this chapter, this word smite is really a key word that keeps popping up again and again in this chapter. It is used for every enemy David faced. And it means that in each battle, David won a decisive and overwhelming victory. The word is used here five times in rapid succession, five times in this chapter, very rapidly, to report on David's smashing victory. He didn't just defeat the enemy, he smote the enemy. That's what's being described here, the magnitude of his victories in each case. No army could withstand David's forces. I mean, think about the Philistines for a minute. The Philistines had been a thorn in Israel's side for generations. They had been a thorn in the side of the people of God for generations, but here David basically finishes them off. We've been hearing about the Philistines again and again and again. We're not going to hear about from the Philistines again for a really long time after this defeat. They pretty much disappear. In fact, they're never really the same kind of enemy or hindrance to the people of God that they had been prior to this. In verse 2, David defeats Moab to the east. He smites them as well. Now, this is interesting. David had been on good terms with the Moabites prior to this conflict. In fact, David himself, David had Moabite blood running in his veins. David was a descendant of Ruth, the Moabitess. If you go back and read the book of Ruth, you will see this. The book of Ruth ends with a genealogy that includes David. Further, in 1 Samuel 22, David left his parents in Moab for their safety. David's parents sought refuge in Moab when Saul was pursuing David. David did not want his family getting caught up in the crossfire. He did not want, you know, and Saul, in his desire to hurt David, David realized he needed to get his family to a safe place, so he takes them to Moab. So you rewind in history a bit, David's got a good relationship with Moab, good enough that he can leave his parents there for safekeeping. Back in Deuteronomy, when Israel was about to enter the promised land, Moses told them to leave Moab alone because Moab's land was not given to Israel. It was not part of the promised land. They could trade with Moab, but they were not to meddle with the Moabites or fight against them. But of course, now things have changed because, as we know from Psalm 60, Moab has invaded Israel, and so Moab will get what it deserves. In fact, in Psalm 60, as David describes his victory, he says Moab is his washpot. That means that Moab has become like a basin you would use to wash your feet in. That's what Moab becomes. Moab has been put under the feet of David, under his dominion. And you look at this here, he kills two-thirds of their fighting men, which was actually being merciful compared to what he could have done. He begins to receive tribute from the rest, from those who survive. The treasures of Moab belong to God's Messiah, to God's king, to God's son, that is, to David. And of course, Scripture teaches us this again and again in different ways. Proverbs says, the riches of the wicked are stored up for the righteous. In Isaiah chapter 60, the prophet describes the treasures of the different nations, the treasures of all the nations being brought into God's kingdom. Really, that's what you see happening here. And of course, you can see how this foreshadows what Jesus will do when he is enthroned. Obviously, Jesus wages a very different kind of warfare, but ultimately the wealth and treasures of the nations will flow into his kingdom. The nations belong to Jesus. The glories and treasures of the nations belong to Jesus. Just as the treasures of Moab belong to David, so the treasures of all the nations belong to Jesus. It's important to understand that David was not the aggressor in these wars. David was not some bloodthirsty imperialist. He was not trying to become a dictator ruling over the entire Middle East. He fought a defensive war against Moab to protect his people and his place. Clearly here, he is motivated by a love for his own, a love for his home, for his family, for his people, for his God. He's not waging wars of aggression. He's fighting to defend what belongs to him. God assigned borders to Israel as a nation, and David rightly wanted the nation to have strong borders, so he enforces those borders and repels an invasion. I'd say that there's a lot of modern civil rulers who could learn something from David here. David knew what the borders were supposed to be, and he enforced them. And it's interesting, too, if you go back, and we can't go into all the details of this, but if you go back and look at the rules for warfare that God gave to his people in the book of Deuteronomy, you will see that David is careful to obey those rules at every point. David is not going to war with peaceful neighbors who are minding their own business. David is at war because he has been attacked. In all of these wars, David is either, again, recovering land that rightfully belongs to Israel, or he is repelling invaders trying to take land, trying to overrun Israel. David is waging holy and just wars authorized by God. That's what you see here. Well, in verses 3 through 8, David defeats Hadad-Ezer, the king of Zobah to the north. The name Hadad-Ezer means Hadad is my help. Hadad is another name for the pagan god Baal. So he's relying on Baal for help, but obviously his god fails to help him in battle because David defeats him. And of course, David defeats him because David is relying on Yahweh, on the true God, to help him. So when David defeats Hadad-Ezer, it's clear Yahweh has defeated Hadad. We are told that this battle was specifically to recover territory around the Euphrates that Hadad-Ezer had taken from Israel. So again, David here is restoring lands that belong to Israel around the Euphrates River. And again, we see David is not building up a war machine. There's no military-industrial complex here. David's victory is total, but look at what he does. He captures their chariots, their horsemen, and their foot soldiers. But the laws of kingship in Deuteronomy 17 forbade Israel's king from multiplying horses. A king could have horses, but not too many. So David only keeps 100 chariots and their horses, a relatively small number. He destroys 9/10 of the chariots because he wanted to obey God. The Syrians tried to aid Hadad-Ezer against David, but David defeated them as well. He takes down this whole alliance of pagan powers. He kills 22,000 Syrian soldiers, and he placed garrisons in Damascus. It's important to understand, you know, you pick up a lot of principles as you go through stories like this. It's important to understand peace through strength is a biblical principle of warfare. Peace through strength is a biblical principle of international relations, and David puts it into practice here. Again, David's not being aggressive, but he's also not being dumb. These garrisons will serve as a kind of border patrol to make sure an invasion like this doesn't happen again. It's a way of keeping an eye on the enemy, making sure that the border is not crossed or invaded in some kind of way. As with Moab, so with Syria, according to the biblical laws of warfare, David had a right to take tribute from them, and so he does. Syria becomes a vassal state, a tributary state for Israel. Verse 7 tells us that tribute included shields of gold. Because gold is a soft metal, these must have been decorative or ceremonial shields, not the kind of shields you would actually use in battle, but obviously they were valuable. So we're told David took them back to Jerusalem. We'll return to that point in just a minute. He also took a large amount of bronze. So David is building up wealth as he's winning these victories. The end of verse 6 tells us something that we should already know because it's obvious, but it's a good reminder. The Lord preserved David wherever he went. The text is telling us here that God was with David and God was for David. God gave him these victories. That same formula, that same refrain, that same truth is repeated down in verse 13 as another reminder that these victories David won were gifts of God. Obviously, these victories required great skill and courage on David's part. No doubt, under his training and leadership, the men of Israel had become a very competent and formidable fighting force. But here's the thing, and I think anybody who knows about the history of warfare would tell you this. I don't care how skilled you are. I don't care how skilled David was in warfare. You don't go undefeated in battles like this. You don't win on multiple fronts at once unless God is with you, unless God is working for you and fighting for you to give you the victory. These military successes did not happen apart from David's bravery and effort and skill, but ultimately these victories were gifts of God, God's grace. And David knew that. Again, if you go look at the Psalms that pair up with this chapter here, Psalm 60, Psalm 108, you see David giving credit to God for these victories. Psalm 108 in particular is interesting. There, David talks about how God uses his people as his weaponry. God uses his people as his weapons against the wicked. And he ends the psalm by saying, God treads our enemies under his feet. What's happening when David goes to war? God is treading down the wicked. And again, you can see connections with the church and our warfare today. This is so important. If you ask, how does a passage like this apply to us today? Well, here, I'm going to tell you. This is the kind of thing you should think about. Again, obviously, in the new covenant, we wage spiritual warfare primarily. Think about Ephesians chapter 6. Paul says, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, the authorities, and the cosmic powers of darkness. Paul says we use the whole armor of God to stand against the schemes of the devil. That's our warfare. That's what we call spiritual warfare. He says we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. In 2 Corinthians 10, which we read this morning, Paul says something very similar. He says, though we walk in the flesh, we do not wage war according to the flesh. So we are warriors, we do wage war, but not according to the flesh. Paul says, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but have divine power to destroy strongholds. Okay? Paul says, we destroy arguments. This is how new covenant warfare is waged. We don't destroy people, we destroy arguments. We don't destroy people, we destroy their false beliefs, their false worldview. Paul goes on, he says, we destroy every lofty opinion that raises itself up against the knowledge of God, that we might take every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. That's how Paul describes our new covenant warfare. We use arguments to bring people's thoughts into submission to Christ and his word. That's how Paul describes the Christian's warfare. We fight against the false ideologies, the false beliefs, the false religions. We make arguments that destroy those strongholds, those false opinions. We make arguments that tear down every anti-biblical opinion people have. That's our mission. And of course, all Christians are included in this mission. All Christians are warriors. All Christians are involved in this battle. We're called to this. At the heart of what we call the culture war is really a spiritual war. And here Paul is telling us how to fight it. We don't use a sword of iron in most of the battles we're called to fight. We use the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. We want to claim the nations God has promised us. We want to disciple the nations as Jesus has commanded us. This is how we do it. This is how we fight. This is how we conquer. This is our warfare. But like David, when we fight, we have to fight with skill. We have to fight with competence. We have to fight with courage. We have to use the weapons God has given to us, and we have to wield them skillfully. Weapons like psalms, and prayer, and preaching, and service. And when we gain victories, we know the Lord has blessed us even as he blessed David. Every victory comes from the Lord. The most interesting battle, I think, is the one that is recorded in verses 9 and 10. Toi, the king of Hamath, hears that David has defeated the army of Hadad-Ezer. In verse 10, we learn that Toi had his own war with Hadad-Ezer and apparently had not gone well for him. So when David defeats Hadad-Ezer, by implication, he rescues Toi as well. When David defeats Hadad-Ezer, he delivers Toi from Hadad-Ezer as well. Now, this is what's interesting. 1 Chronicles 18 has a parallel account of these battles, but it's interesting. In Chronicles, Toi's son is named Hadoram, which means Hadad is exalted. Can you remember, Hadad is the name of Baal, a false god. Toi's son is named Hadoram, which means Hadad is exalted. So that means either that Toi and his son worship the same god as Hadad-Ezer, even though they were fighting against each other, or Hadad-Ezer had so thoroughly conquered Toi that Toi's son had been renamed after Hadad-Ezer, after Hadad-Ezer's god. But this is what's interesting. In 2 Samuel, so in Samuel's account of this, that's the Chronicles account, in Samuel's account, 2 Samuel 8, Toi's son is named Jotham, which means Yahweh is exalted. In Samuel's account, Toi's son is named after the true God, after David's God, after Yahweh. So Chronicles' account, he's named after an idol. He's named after Hadad-Ezer's God. In Samuel's account, he's named after David's God, after the true God. Why the name change? Well, it is a sign that when David defeated Hadad-Ezer and thus delivered Toi, Toi and his son converted to the worship of the true God. Toi and his son became worshipers of Israel's God, of David's God. The true God became their God. These Gentiles began worshiping the God of Israel. And so look at what happens in verse 10. Toi sends his son, Jotham, to greet David and to bless him. And Toi's son brings gifts. He brings tribute like these other nations David defeated. But in this case, the tribute is voluntary. So it is also different from the other nations. He brings David articles of silver, gold, and bronze. Now think about this. Remember how Psalm 2 ends? At the end of Psalm 2, David gives the Gentile kings a choice. They can either kiss the Son of God and submit to him, or they will be smashed by the Son of God. That's the choice. kiss the Son or be smashed by the Son. That is exactly the choice these Gentile kings in 2 Samuel 8 face. Those who rebel against God's anointed king get smashed. Toi makes the right choice, and he is blessed. And no doubt when his son Joram greeted David in verse 10, he greeted him with a kiss, just as Psalm 2 requires. Toi's loyalty to David provided Israel with a valuable ally to the north. That was certainly true. But there's more going on here than just a pragmatic political alliance. Toi and his kingdom are not only saved politically, they are saved spiritually as well. They become loyal to David and to his God. In verse 14, we see the defeat of Edom to the south. We've already seen Edom was in alliance with Moab. When David defeats the Edomites, they become servants paying tribute, and David sets up garrisons there to protect his people and his nation. One more note before looking at the final section. David is obviously collecting a lot of plunder as a result of all of these victories. In fact, there are other nations besides those that he defeats that we see the battle recounted here. There are other nations he was collecting plunder from. They're listed there in verse 12. What did he do with all this plunder? What did David do with all this tribute? Well, verse 11 tells us he dedicated all of it to the Lord. God gave David these victories, so David gave God the tribute. It works like this. This is the logic of it. Just like the plunder the Israelites took from the Egyptians when they left Egypt in the Exodus, just like that plunder was used to build God's house, so it is here. David has been told he won't build God's house himself. So what is he going to do? He'll do the next best thing. He's going to collect all the materials so his son, Solomon, can build the house when the time is right. And you can go look at 1 Chronicles chapter 22. 1 Chronicles 22 details how much of these precious metals David brought in. In today's dollars, it would be worth well over $500 billion. Not million. Billion, $500 billion. That was David's building fund. That was his building budget for Solomon's temple. So it's not a surprise that when Solomon's temple was finally built, it was such a magnificent building. You know, if you think what we're trying to build is expensive, you think we're trying to raise a lot of money, look at what David did. Look at what David did here. Now, given all of these victories and the massive wealth David accumulated, it's not a surprise. Verse 13 tells us that God's promise to make David's name great was fulfilled. Remember, just as God promised to make Abraham's name great, he promised to make David's name great, and here God makes good on that promise. Any man winning battles like this and gathering tribute like this is obviously going to have a great name, and David certainly does. The tail end of this chapter in verses 15 through 18 would be easy to skip over, but I don't think we should. There's a lot here that's valuable. It is a summary of David's kingdom at this point in time. It gives us a sense of what a well-oiled, smoothly running nation looks like. We find David was not only successful in war, he was a good and just ruler of his people. He ruled for their good, for the common good of the people of Israel. He was not so preoccupied with foreign wars that he neglected a domestic agenda. He set up a well-organized nation. There was no swamp that needed draining in the days of David's kingdom. In these days, David's kingdom included a smoothly running, effective, efficient government that had integrity, that was faithful and obedient to God. Verse 15 tells us he administered justice and judgment over all of Israel for all his people. All of Israel prospered under his reign because David rules in justice and judgment. And if you look at the way those words are used in the Bible, they're used very broadly to encompass what a king does. If the purpose of civil government is to secure the God-given rights and freedoms of a people, David did it. He was a just and righteous ruler. Under David's rule at this stage, You could say life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness were secured for each and every Israelite. Good civil government, competent civil government, wise civil government is a great blessing, and David provided that blessing for his people. You look at this and everything it says here, you might say, David promoted the public good. He promoted ordered liberty and the national security of his people, which is exactly what a civil magistrate should do. He is the model ruler at this point. Now, he won't stay that way, but at this point, that's true. His rule ensured domestic tranquility and provided for the common defense and promoted the general welfare of his people. Again, David fulfilled all the duties of a civil magistrate. You go look at the civil magistrate's job description, so to speak, in Romans 13, and several other scriptures address this, and you look at how that has been reflected in the Christian tradition, including America's founding documents. And what you see is the duties of a civil magistrate, the duties of a properly constituted civil government, are fulfilled by David here. Then we're given some information about David's cabinet. We're told about Joab, who was his secretary of war, a highly skilled, if sometimes ruthless, military man who we first met back in chapter 2, and he'll show up again. Jehoshaphat, who was the recorder or the court historian who chronicled David's reign. Zadok and Ahimelech, who were the chief priests. We're not sure exactly why David had two chief priests. But one thing is clear, in his role as king, David supported the worship and work of the church, as he should have, as a good ruler will do. A good ruler will support the church in her worship and work, and that's what David does. I think this is why he has two, most likely. It seems most likely that Ahimelech served as a priest in the tabernacle of Moses in Gibeon, while Zadok served as a priest in the tent of David in Jerusalem. I mean, we're not told that, so there's some speculation there, but that is my guess, because there were two places of worship at this point in Israel's history, so perhaps that's why there are two chief priests. Verse 18 says, Benaniah, who we know more about him from Chronicles, he was a military commander, and he organized David's royal guard, the Kerethites and the Pelethites and Sariah. The Kelethites and the Pelethites are military guards or bodyguards for the king. So this is like the secret service for David. Perhaps they're also executioners. Sariah is likely a courier who delivers messages for the army. What you see here, these are elite men serving in important military roles. But there's another little wrinkle here that we need to take note of. The Kerethites and Pelethites, those are ethnic names. That is to say, they are Gentiles. These are Gentiles serving in high security positions in David's military. It's just so interesting how this happened. You know, we saw it with Obed-Edom. We see it throughout. We've seen it in this chapter. David keeps attracting Gentiles. He keeps bringing Gentiles into his kingdom. And, of course, that is a foreshadowing of what Jesus, the son of David, will do when the nations stream into his kingdom. But David's already doing, and he's bringing Gentiles into his kingdom. But note also what this means, just to make this really practical. David did not play the game of racial or ethnic identity politics. He was willing to include Gentiles in his administration if they were loyal to God, you know, loyal to David's God and loyal to David himself, and if they were competent, he would include them in his administration. We'll see this again in a few chapters with Uriah the Hittite. Okay, he's a Hittite. He's a Gentile serving in David's military. This is really an important point to understand about David's administration. David valued character and competence in his kingdom. He valued loyalty to God over, let's just say, ethnicity. His kingdom was a kind of meritocracy where excellence was rewarded, irrespective of ethnicity in many cases. Loyal, faithful Gentiles could be grafted into his kingdom and were often given high-ranking positions in his kingdom. If they trusted God, David knew he could trust them. And if they were competent, he did not mind putting them in these kinds of positions. Finally, we were told David's sons were priests. Now, this is kind of odd. Some translations, the one Michael read for us this morning, calls them chief ministers, but the word is priest. Now, obviously, they're not Levites, so they did not offer sacrifice or serve in the tabernacle. The word priest, it's important to understand, the word priest really just means royal servant. A priest is one who serves in a royal palace. So you got two sets of priests here, so to speak. You've got Zadok and Ahimelech, who were ecclesiastical priests, who are carrying out liturgical ministries in the tabernacle of Moses and the tent of David. They're the ones leading the people in sacrifice, and they're the ones who are teaching the word of God. And then David's sons are civil priests. They serve in David's house as members of the royal court. Now, there's 2 Samuel 8. I've made some applications already along the way, but I want to close with this. I want to try to tie all of this together and make it very, very relevant to our situation, the situation we face in this moment. All of this taken together in this chapter serves to give us an image of Christ's kingdom. This is what Christ's kingdom looks like. This is what Christ's kingdom does. Now, again, obviously, we have to make adjustments, as I already noted, redemptive historical adjustments. We don't fight with the sword of iron primarily. We fight with the sword of the word. We don't aim to destroy our enemies, but their arguments. We don't aim to destroy our enemies. We aim to convert them. But of course, we even get hints of that here, with the Gentiles who choose David to be their king and David's God to be their God. David's already converting Gentiles. He's already doing the spiritual warfare thing too, right along with his physical warfare. We see David in this chapter racking up victories, growing his kingdom to its promised size. Jesus will do the same. Jesus' victories in history might come more slowly. Yeah, we're not going to read about them all in just a few paragraphs on one page. His victories might come more slowly, but Jesus' victories in history are just as sure. And as his new covenant people, as God's new covenant people, we have not just been promised a small piece of land in the Middle East. That was typological, too, of something much greater. We've been promised the whole world. In Romans 4:13, Paul says the promise to Abraham is that he would be heir of the world, heir of all nations. And so as sons of Abraham, we are heirs of the whole world. Church, understand, God has promised you the world. God has promised you the nations. Every nation, every family will be blessed by Jesus, the seed of Abraham and the seed of David. And that blessing, the blessing of Jesus, flows out to the world through the church. That blessing flows out from the church to the nations as they are converted and brought under Jesus' reign as they begin to bring their tribute into his kingdom. Passages like 2 Samuel 8 assure us that the kingdom of Christ will grow to its promised size, which is to say, Jesus will inherit the nations. Jesus' kingdom will fill the earth. Now, when I say something like that, you might find that hard to believe. That might be hard to believe in our day because you look at the world around you right now and you think, well, how could this world ever be converted to Jesus on such a massive scale? In our day, it seems Satan has invaded our culture. It seems he has infiltrated and now controls most of our culture's institutions. And people are making their thoughts obedient to Satan instead of Christ. They're believing Satan's lies instead of Jesus' truth. That's the reality of the situation we're in. I think that's a pretty fair assessment of the situation we're in. But this is what I would tell you, church. We must not blame Satan for what is happening in our culture. We should not blame Satan for this. Satan's doing what Satan always does. Nor can we blame, say, the leftists or the progressives for the debasement and degeneration of our culture. No, the only people we can blame for this is ourselves. We have to blame ourselves. We have to blame the church. This is the church's fault because we have failed to do what David did here. David guarded Israel. He protected the people of God. He protected what was true, good, and beautiful. He was vigilant.
He fought, and he fought with courage, and he fought with skill. The biggest reason for all the problems we see in our culture, all the degeneration, all the degeneracy, all the darkness we see in our culture is simple. It's this: the church has failed to be salt and light. And in failing to be salt and light, we have surrendered rather than fighting back. And so you think about the way the history of the West has unfolded. It took centuries to build it, but Christendom was a reality. Western, what we call Western civilization, was in all kinds of ways a Christian civilization, a civilization that in all kinds of ways reflected God's goodness, beauty, and truth. But because a series of generations of Christians, particularly Christian men, came along who failed to be vigilant, who failed to guard what had been built, we've lost it, or we're in grave danger of losing it. We failed to fight the battles that needed to be fought to protect our people and our place, to protect what is good and true and beautiful. And because we have failed to fight those battles, what's happened? We have lost territory. We didn't fight to keep it, so we lost it. We compromised. Battles do not stay won. Once won, once you win a battle, you have to defend what you have fought for, what you have conquered, what you have captured. We haven't done it. There's always going to be a new battle to fight. We have failed to fight. And we have failed to fight the way we need to fight for several generations now. Now, we're going to see David do the same thing later on. David himself becomes a kind of parable of failing to fight when you need to fight. And everything David built up is going to crumble down around him. That's what we're seeing in our world as well. When godly men fail to fight the good fight, when Christian men let Satan gain ground and win battles, when Christian men let down their guard, what do we call that? We call that effeminacy. Effeminate men are the bane of the church. Soft men, weak men, effeminate men are the bane of the church today. That's what we see all around us. It's a failure of nerve, a failure of courage, a failure to take responsibility, a failure to pursue our mission to be salt and light. It is a failure to fight, a failure to fight the good fight. Christian men in our age have been too weak to defend the civilizational inheritance God gave us. So this is my exhortation to you, especially you men. Do what David did here, not what David does later on when he faltered and compromised. Do what David did here, fight. Fight for God and the gospel. Fight for what is good, true, and beautiful. Fight for and defend the people and place you love, the country and civilization and culture your ancestors built by the grace of God. Fight. Fight to take hold of what God has promised you. In the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, amen.